Hello, this is Zach. You're listening to Creepypastas Told in the Dark, and today I am reading The Burned House by Vincent O'Sullivan.
The Burned House
by Vincent O'Sullivan. One night at the end of dinner, the last time I crossed the Atlantic, somebody in our group remarked that we were just passing over the spot where the Lusitania had gone down. Whether this was the case or not, the thought of it was enough to make us rather grave, and we dropped into some more or less serious discussion about the emotion of men and women who see all hope gone and realize that they are going to sink with the vessel. From that, the talk wondered to the fate of the drowned was not theirs, after all, a fortunate end. Somebody related details from the narratives of those who had been all but drowned in the accidents of the war. A Scottish lady inquired fancifully if the ghosts of those who are lost at sea ever appear above the waters and come aboard ships, would there be danger of seeing one with when the light was turned out in her cabin? This put an end to all seriousness, and most of us laughed. But a little tight-faced man from Fall River, bleak and iron gray, who had been listening attentively, did not laugh. The lady noticed his decorum and appealed to him for support. "You are like me. You believe in ghosts?" she asked lightly. He hesitated, thinking over it. "In ghosts?" he repeated slowly. No. "I don't know as I do. I've never had any personal experience that way. I've never seen the ghost of anyone I knew. Has anybody here?" No replies. Instead, most of us laughed again. A little uneasy, perhaps. "Well, I guess not," reassumed the man from Fall River. "All the same, strange enough, things happened in life. Enough if you cut out ghosts that you can't clear up by laughing. You laugh till you had some experience big enough to shock you, and then you didn't laugh anymore. It's like being thrown out of a car." At this moment, there was a blast on a whistle, and everybody rushed up on deck. As it turned out, we had only entered into a belt of fog. On the upper deck, I fell in again with the New Englander, smoking a cigar and walking up and down. We took a few turns together, and he referred to the conversation at dinner. Our laughter eventually rankled in his mind. "So many dang strange things happen in life that you can't account for," he protested. "You can't go on laughing at faith, healing, and at dreams. And this and that. And then something comes along that you just can't explain. You have gone to throw up your hands and allow that it doesn't answer to any tests our experience has provided us with. Now, I guess I am as matter of a fact a man as any of those folks down there. I'm in the outfitting business. My favorite author is Ingersoll. Whenever I go on a journey like this, I carry one of his books. If you read Ingersoll and think Ingersoll year in, year out, you don't have much use for wool gathering. But once I had an experience which I had not concluded was out of the ordinary, whether other people believed it or not, whether they think they can explain it, that don't matter. It happened to me, and I could no more doubt it than I could doubt having had a tooth pulled after the dentist had done it. I only wish Igrisol was still alive. I'd like to put it up to him. If you will sit down here with me in this corner out of wind, I'll tell you it how it was. Some years ago, I had to be for several months in New York. I was before the courts. I did not signify now what for, and it was all forgotten by this time. But it was a long and worrying case, and it aged me by 20 years. Well, sir, all through the trial in that grimy courtroom, I kept thinking and thinking of a fresh little place I knew in the Vermont hills. And I helped to get through the hours by thinking that if things went well with me, I'd go there at once. And so it was that on the very next morning after I was acquitted, I stepped on the cars at the Grand Central Station. It was the early fall, the days were closing in, and it was night and cold when I arrived. The village was very dark and deserted. They don't go out much after dark in those parts anyhow, and the keen mountain wind was enough to quell any lingering desire. The hotel was not of those modern places called inns from settlement in America, which are equipped and upholstered like the great city hotels. It was one of those really old-fashioned New England taverns, about as uncomfortable places as there are on earth. Where the idea is to show the traveler that traveling in a penitential state, and that morally and physically the best place for him to home. For him is home. The landlord bought me a kind of supper with his hat on, a pipe in his mouth. The room was chilly, but when I asked for a fire, he said he guessed he couldn't go out to the wood pile till morning. There was nothing else to do when I had eaten my supper but go outside, both to get the smell of the lamp out of my nose and to warm myself up by a short walk. As I did not know the country well, I did not mean to go far, but although it was an overcast night with a high northeast wind with occasional flurry of rain, the moon was up and even concealed by clouds as it was, it yet lit the night with a kind of twilight gray, not vivid like the open moonlight, but good enough to see some distance. On account of this, I polygoned my stroller and kept walking on and on till I was a considerable way from the village, and in a region as lonely as anywhere in the state. Great trees and shrubs bordered the road, and many feet below was a mountain stream. What with a passion of the wind pouring through the high trees and the shout of the water racing among the boulders, it seemed to me sometimes like the noise of the crowd of people, and two or three times I turned to see if a crowd might be out after me, as I knew that no crowd would be there. Sometimes the branches of the trees seemed so thick that I was walking as if in a black pit, unable to see my hands close to my face. Then coming out of the tunnel of branches, I would step once more into the gray clearness which opened to the road and surrounding country a good way on all sides. I suppose it might be some 3/4 of an hour I had been walking when I came to a fork of the road. One branch ran downward, getting almost on a level with the bed of the torrent. The other mounted in a steep hill, And this, after a little idle debating, I decided to follow. After I had climbed for more than half a mile, thinking that if I should happen to lose track of one of the landmarks, I should be very badly lost. The path, for it was now no more than that, curved, and I came out on a broad plateau. There, to my astonishment, I saw a house. It was a good-sized wooden house, 3 stories high, with a piazza round 2 sides of it, and from the elevation on which it stood, it commanded as a far stretch of country. There were a few great trees at a little distance from the house, and behind it, a stone's thrown away, with a clump of bushes. Still, it looked lonely and stark, offering its 4 sides unprotected to the winds. For all that, I was very glad to see it. It does not matter how I thought, whether I have lost my way or not. The house people will set me right. But when I came up to it, I found that it was to be all appearance uninhabited. The shutters were closed on all the windows. There was not a spark of light anywhere. There was something about it, something sinister and barren, that gave me the kind of shiver that you have at the door of a room where you know that a dead man lies inside, or if you think you get thinking hard about dropping over the rail into a black waste of water out there. This feeling, you know, isn't altogether unpleasant. You relish all the better your present security. It was the same with me standing before that house. I was not really scared. I was alone up here, miles from any kind of help, at the mercy of whoever might be lurking behind the shutters of that sullen house. But I feel that by all the chances, I was perfectly alone and safe. My sensations of uncanny was due to the effect of the nerves pronounced by wild scenery and the unexpected sight of a house in such a very lonely situation. Thus, I reasoned, instead of following the road farther, I walked over the grass till I came to a stone wall, perhaps 250 yards in front of the house, and rested my arm on it, looking forth at the scent. On the crest of the hill, far away, was a strange light lingering, like the first touch of dawn on the sky on a rainy morning, or the last glimpse of twilight before night comes. Between me and the hills, as a wide stretch of open country, on my right hand was an apple orchard, and I observed that a stile had been made in the wall of piled stones to enable the house people to go back and forth. Now, after I had been there, leaning on the wall some considerable time, I saw a man coming towards me through the orchard. He was walking with a good free stride, and as he drew near, I could see that he was a tall, snooty fellow between 25 or 30, with a shaven face, wearing a slouch hat of the country, a dark woolen shirt, and high boots. When he reached the stile and began climbing over it, I bade him good night in neighborly fashion. He made no reply, but he looked me straight in the face, and the look just gave me a qualm. Not that it was an evil face, you mind. It was a handsome, serious face, but it was ravaged by some terrible passion. Stealth was on it, ruthless and deadly resolution. And at the same time, such a look as a man driven by some uncontrollable power might throw on surrounding things. Asking for comprehension and mercy, it was impossible for me to resent his churlishness. His thoughts were so certainly elsewhere, I doubt if he even saw me. He could not have gone by more than a quarter of a mile when I turned to look after him. He had disappeared. The plateau lay bare before me, and it seemed impossible that even if he had sprinted like an athlete, he could not have gotten inside the house in so little time. But I have always made it a rule to attribute what I cannot understand to natural causes, and I have failed to observe, I said to myself, that no doubt the man had gone back into the orchard by some other opening in the wall. Lower down, there might be some flaw in my vision, owing to this uncertain and distorting light. But even as I continued to look toward the house, leaning my back now against the wall, I noticed that there were lights sprinkling up in the windows behind the shutters. They were flickering lights now, bright, now dim, and had a ruddy glow, like firelight. Before I had looked long, I became convinced that it was indeed firelight. The house was on fire. Black smoke began to pour from the roof. The red sparks flew in the wind. Then, at the window above the roof of the plaza, the shutters were thrown open. I heard a woman shriek. I ran toward the house as hard as I could, and then I drew near, and I could see her plainly. She was a young woman. Her hair fell in disorder over her white nightgown. She stretched out her bare arms, screaming. I saw a man come behind her and seize her, but they were caught in a trap. The flames were licking around the windows, and the smoke was killing them. Even now, the part of the house where they stood was caving in. Appalled by the horrible tragedy which had thus suddenly risen before me, I made my way nearer the house, thinking that if the two could struggle to the side of the house, not bound by the plaza, they might jump, and I might break the fall. I was shouting this at them. I was right up close to the fire, and then I was struck by... I noticed for the first time an astonishing thing. The flames had no heat to them. I was standing near enough of the fire to be singed by it, and yet I felt no heat. The sparks were flying around my head, and some fell my hand, and they did not burn. And now I persevered that although the smoke was rolling in columns, I was not choked by this smoke, and that there had been no smell of smoke since the fire broke out. Neither was there any glare against the sky. As I stood there, stifled, wondering how these things could be, the whole house was swept up by a very tornado of flame and crashed down in a red ruin. Struck by the heart of the abominable catastrophe, I made my way, uncertain, down the hill, shouted for help. As I came to a little wooden bridge spanning the torrent just beyond, the road forked. I saw what appeared to be a rope and loose coils laying there. I saw part of it was fastened to the rail of the bridge and hung outside. I looked over. There was a man's body swinging by the neck between the road and the stream. I leant over still farther, and I recognized him as the man I had seen come out the orchard. His hat had fallen off, and the toes of his boots were touched in water. It seemed hardly possible, and yet I was certain that the man and he was hanging there. I scrambled down to the side of the bridge and put both my hands to seize the body that might I lift up and relieve the weight of the rope. I succeeded in the body so that I might lift it up and relieve the weight of the rope. I succeeded in clutching hold of the loose shirt. And for a second, I thought that I had come away in my hand. Then I thought that my hand had closed on nothing, and I clutched nothing but air. And yet the figure swung on the neck, on by the neck before my eyes. I was suffocated with such horror that I feared for a moment I might lose consciousness. The next minute, I was running and stumbling along the dark road that in mortal anxiety. My idea being to rouse the town and bring men to the bridge that I say was my intention, but the fact is when I came at last inside of the village, I slowed down instinctively and began to reflect. After all, I was unknown there. I had just gone through a disagreeable trial in New York, and rural people were notorious giving to groundless suspicion. I had enough of the law on my arrest without sufficient evidence. The wisest thing to do would be to drop a hint or two before the landlord and judge by his demeanor whether to proceed. I found him swinging there. I had left him smoking in his shirt sleeves with his hat on. "Well," he said slowly, "I don't know where the gosh blam blazes you had gone to, been to see the folks." I told him that I had been taking a walk. I went on to mention casually that the folk on the hill and a plateau and who lived in the house, I asked with a good show of indifference on top of the hill. He stared. "House? There ain't no house up there," he said positively. Old Joe Snecker, who owns the land, says he's going to build a house on top up there for his son to live in with when he gets married. But that ain't begun yet, and some folks reckon he never will. "I feel sure I saw a house," I protested feebly, but I was thinking, no heat in the fire, no substance in the body. I had not the courage to dispute. The landlord looked at me not unkindly. "You seem sort of sick," he remarked. Guess you've been doing too much down in that city. What you want is to go to bed." The man from Fall River paused for a moment. We sat silent, listening to the pant of the machinery, the thumping of the wind. In the wire stay and the lash of the sea. Some voices were singing on the deck below. I considered him with the shade of contemplatively superior, we felt, as a rule, toward those who tell us their dreams or what some fortune teller had predicted. Hallucinations, I said at last, with reassuring incredulity, trick of the vision, toxic amphisimile. After the long strain of your trial, your nerves were shattered, and what I thought myself, he replied shortly, especially after I had been out to the plateau the next morning and saw no sign of the house had ever stood there, and no corpse at the bridge. I said and laughed, no corpse at the bridge? He tried to get a light from another cigar. This took him some little time, and when at last he managed it, he got out his chair and stood looking down at me. Now listen here. I told you that the thing happened several years ago. I'd got almost to forget it. If you can only persuade yourself that the thing was a freak of imagination, it pretty soon gets dimmed out your head. Delusions have not staying power once it is realized that they are delusions. Whenever it did come back to me, I used to think now how near I had once been to get going out of my mind. That was all. Well, last year I went up to the village again from Boston. I went to the same hotel and found the same landlord. He remembered me at once as the feller who came up from the city and thought he see a house. I believe you had the Jim Jams, he said. You laughed at the landlord spat. There'd been a house there since, though, has there? Why, yes, ain't it had been as if there had never been. Why, yes, ain't it had been as well if there never had been. Old man Sneaker Decker built it for his son, a fine big house with a plaza on two sides. The son, young Joe, got courting Mammy Eltlin from here around. She'd gone down to work in a store somewhere in Connecticut. Darned if I can remember where. New Haven or Danbury. Maybe. Well, sir, she used to get carrying on with another young feller about here. Jim Taverns and Jim was sure wild about her. Used to save up his quarters to go down state to see her, but she turned him down at the end and married Joe. I guess became Joe had the house and the old man's money to accept. Well, poor Jim must had gone plumb crazy. What do you think he did? The very first night the new wed pair spent in that house, he burned it down. Burned the two of them in their bed, and he was as nice and quiet as a feller as you want to see. He may have been full of whiskey at the time. No, he wasn't, I said. The landlord looked surprised. I guess you've heard some of it. No, go on. Yes, sir. He burned them in their bed. And then what do you think he did? He hung himself at a little bridge a half mile below. Do you remember where the road divides? Well, it was there. I saw the body hanging hanging there myself the next morning, with the toes of his boots were just touching the water. Thank you for tuning in to Creepout Soul in the Dark. I read Burned House by Vince O'Sullivan. And thank you for watching, listening.